Blog Talk Radio.
Dog Works Training Centers, professional canine training center in Denver, Colorado, presents Mush, You Huskies, a show about dog-powered sports and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Mush, You Huskies, is part of Twine Group Media and syndicated worldwide on blogtalkradio.com. Here's your host, Dr. Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto and our continuing coverage of the 2011 Iditarod. It is our 10th day of coverage here on the radio. And without further ado, I want to introduce Michelle, our co-host calling in from Denver, and our Iditarod expert and co-host during the Iditarod, Jason Barron, calling in from Montana. Guys, how are you?
Well, I'm doing great.
You know, it's a crazy Monday, even for people that are not running in the race. I know the guys that are in the lead or in the top 10, they're really pushing to go. And it was funny because all three of us just got a chance to call in with about 5 minutes to spare. And I tell you what, that makes us nervous sometimes when we're sitting there looking at an empty switchboard and nobody's called in yet. So I appreciate you guys calling. And I know it's busy for wherever we are. Michelle's even sitting in the car in the driveway so she doesn't lose cell phone service, and that's the nature of an internet radio show. What are you doing today, Jason? What's going on?
Well, I've been trying to get my ducks in a row for some long day of coverage tomorrow, and basically just I've actually been cutting firewood for part of this morning, but we still use wood heat up here at my place, and I just bucked up a big old downed tree and got up here and started splitting it and remembered, oh, I got this show I need to go be a part of, so I came running in here to get on the phone. That's why I'm late.
I appreciate it. No problem. I'm glad you're here. You know, the first thing I want to get into before we get started in our analysis, I want to thank all of our people that are following our show, and that takes a special extra step for those people. They have clicked on the follow button on Blog Talk Radio, and that means that they're getting a email or a text message or whatever message that they send out, so they will get an update of when this show airs. And we now have over 200 people that are following our show, and typically we get 4, 5, 6, up to 10 people per episode all throughout the evening that listen to our show and like it so much that they're now following us. So I do want to appreciate that. You guys are welcomed to the Mush You Huskies radio show, and without Jason's expertise and Michelle's commentary and myself pushing the buttons, I don't think we could have ever made this possible. I want to give everybody a hand for that. So with that, Jason, you know, it's really the last day for the first 2, 3, 4 guys coming into Nome here, and it'll happen sometime late tonight, early tomorrow. What is going on in the first 2 or 3 guys, Jason?
Well, we've had, you know, it's just the Iditarod has been on an amazing pace. I do think we're going to break the record. The first couple teams come in, and you know, we saw that group that essentially just declared war on one another, taking off from the 24s in Dakotna, and they just day after day have pushed so hard and done such a great job with managing their teams and their dogs and their schedules that I'm just always blown away that they stayed with it. As many of them stayed with it as they did. And you know, what we've seen is every, you know, after a few days after they got into the Iditarod, Anvik kind of area, you know, you really started to see the sort of the shock of how hard they've been pushing start to ripple out through some of the competition. And it did. It's turned into, you know, went from being an 8-person race down to a 6-person race, and then it was 5, and then it was, you know, now it's a 2-person race. And basically what's going on out there as we speak is that Baker, every move that Ramey and Hans and Hugh and Sebastian had been, you know, John Baker would make a move, real pro move, take cutting rest and going and making a good run. And those four guys would come chasing after him, and he would see him coming. He'd cut his rest short and take off again. So they keep responding, and he keeps dishing it out, just dishing the punishment, really. I mean, it's really been amazing to watch. I mean, my jaw has been on the ground every time I look at the internet, the times and stuff. And basically what's happened is it's gotten down to the point where late last night, going across the sea ice, Norton Sound over to Koyuk, it boiled down to Ramey Smith is now chasing. You know, John Baker's been in control since Eagle Island. Ramey Smith is the person who's emerged as the last man standing to actually contest him. And I even kind of wonder at this point, for the first time, now watching the transponders pulling into White Mountain, I definitely think that it's going to come down to a foot race, maybe the last 5 miles coming down Friends Street. I predict this is going to be the most exciting finale to the Iditarod since Dick Mackey beat Rick Swenson back in 1978.
Wow, that's a pretty good deal there. If they're going to have to run the last, mile or so down Front Street, that would be a truly great finish. So it's showing right now, Jason, that at the last time out, John Baker left at 8:51 a.m. from Elam, and Smith left at 9:42. So that's what, about 49 mm-hmm. minutes. How much of a lead is that really compared to the two guys? I know you know both of those guys.
It's about 6.5 miles, and basically what it is that they've maintained the relationship with each other all the way from probably about Shagtulik all the way to where they're at. Well, I'll say Koyuk all the way to where they're at now, which is they're going to finish up about the distance apart when they're in White Mountain. And this is significant because, you know, typically the checkpoints don't have any mandatory rest on them. White Mountain does. It has a mandatory 8-hour rest. What that means is that when John pulls in, he's guaranteed a safe distance of however much time he built on Ramey. Ramey can't leave until he's accomplished his, to filled up, burnt up his 8 hours of rest, and then whatever relationship they maintain going into the rest, they're going to maintain going out of it. So think of it as a buffer. In other words, if it was just a regular old checkpoint, I don't even want to think about what would happen if there weren't an 8-hour mandatory there. The way these guys are going, they might not even stop. So basically what I think is going to happen is Baker's going to pull in there. He's going to have kept his 45, 50 minutes on Ramey, and that's the way it's going to boil down to. What we're going to be watching when they take off out of their 8-hour mandatories tonight is we're going to be watching this race all the way to 77 miles to the finish line. It's going to come down to, can Ramey make up that 50 minutes? And that's really what the Iditarod comes down to now. Can he make up that 50 minutes? I mean, John Baker has run a brilliant race. It's as impressive as anything that's ever happened in the Iditarod before. I mean, no driver has ever done a better job, in my opinion. And he's being answered quite well by all the people following him. And it's just, now it's in Ramey's hands to be the man to see if he can topple John. And if not, then John's going to win. And either way, Alaska wins.
So a lot of talk on blogs and Anchorage Daily News and some other sites for the last couple of days have talked about John Baker's dogs and the type of dogs they are, kind of the more furry, hardy, husky-type dogs, as I assume Ramey has more of the sleeker, shorter-haired dogs. Can you tell us why that is a factor on the coast?
Well, typically John Baker is from Kotzebue, and even while some of his dogs may actually come from other regions, I mean, he doesn't just breed up all his own dogs. He actually buys quite a few and imports them. But still, just by virtue of living in Kotzebue, it's hard to express to people how difficult the environment is. I mean, is where Ramey lives and where John lives, quite a difference. And what that really means is that even if they had exactly the same breed of dogs, that John Baker's, after a couple of years of living up there, would just be tougher and more able to withstand those coastal elements, the wind, the open vistas, the brutal cold, the unprotected assault by the elements. And that's what the coast is all about. Now, I don't really think that's happening this year. With that said, the coast is actually, this is one of the reasons they've been able to push so hard with so little rest. All it would take was a little bit of weather and it'd shut this stuff down. You'd see them all be taking more rest. With that said, the trail has been brilliant. It's been an easy trail. The temperature's probably been the closest thing to perfect in Iditarod could have. So, I mean, this has been the perfect year for this type of race, for this type of pace. And, you know, they're pro drivers. They're taking advantage of it and going, you know, going with what the weather will permit them to have. But typically the coast is very windy and it's very cold and it's very, just very brutal weather conditions. And Baker's dogs, by having grown, you know, been spent their lives up in the Kotzebue area, well, they're used to it, whereas a lot of people coming from Big Lake and Montana or, you know, wherever, other regions, you know, their dogs might sort of quail at those conditions.
You know, I've never been out that way yet, and I've been here in Willow, right down the street from where Ramey has his dog yard, and it's relatively mild here. I remember spending winters in northern Minnesota, and they were just brutal compared to this, and I'm sure weather changes from year to year, but this is a relatively mild climate compared to, I assume, up there, White Mountain, Kobuk, those areas, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Willow's the banana belt.
Right, right.
You know,
all
compared
right, so
to that.
Michelle, do you have a question or a statement there?
It's all colder than Colorado right now. We were 70 degrees today. So
short weather and short
sleeves. I don't envy any of y'all up there in the cold today.
There you go. All right, so Jason, before we get into kind of our topic of the day, is there anything else you want to talk about, the standings or strategy or anything else before we move on?
Well, as long as I'm assuming we'll have a few minutes before this is over to explore this. You know, I think we've covered that well enough. You know, I don't want to leave that there's some, you know, there's fans of all these other teams, and I recognize that we've been covering the top five every single night, and I kind of apologize for that, but it's sort of the nature of the beast. I mean, it's just that, you know, we're going to develop the stories of the top drivers the most. But I mean, there's still some great battles going on. I mean, Didi Genro and Jesse Royer, two women who came roaring into the top 10, they're going to finish all in the top 10, and they just kind of came out of nowhere, which is to say the middle of the pack. So apologies to the middle of the packers. It's just, you know, with this type of coverage is what happens. So those two ladies, there's some women that are making some moves. Dee Dee might crack the top five the way she's looking. Dallas Seavey, the Quest champion, has just overtaken Hugh and Sebastian Schnell. He passed them resting at Elam, and he is now on the way to White Mountain. So he has locked them up unless they can out kind of run him to the finish line from like White Mountain. But, you know, they're pulling over because they need the rest. And it's not they need the rest. Their dogs do. And if their dogs do, that's not a good sign that they're going to be able to beat him. So I think Dallas has got a lock on fourth place, and those two drivers are falling back a little bit. And they rolled the dice, and it didn't come out the way they wanted to. And you know, they're probably already planning next year and just taking home a good paycheck. I mentioned that Michelle Phillips hadn't taken. There was rumors that she hadn't taken her 8-hour break, her mandatory 8-hour on the Yukon. That proved to be groundless. The word that came back, again, this is unofficial, but it was unofficial in the first place, was that it was a technical. There was just some sort of glitch. They hadn't signed the paperwork properly when they did the times. She had taken 8 hours of mandatory at Eagle Island, so she's fine. There's another top woman driver from the Quest who's just going to get better and better. You know, 5 years from now, we're going to be talking about Michelle Phillips, like, you know, boy, it's her on the coast winning the race. I mean, one of those type of real exciting new prospects coming into racing as well at the Quest and the Iditarod. And then also Pete Kaiser, a very young man from the YK Delta. He's been running a top race, but kind of in the middle of the pack, obviously husbanding his power and basically just being conservative, because now he's leapt up into a spot that's in contention for the top 10. And in mushing vernacular, we spend so much time getting excited about the winners of these races that we really forget that it's a huge accomplishment to get in the top 15, much less the top 10 or the top 5 or win it. So Pete Kaiser running his second Iditarod. He's a bush rat from the YK Delta, which is just straight up bush country. And total respect for this young man. You know, you're not going to meet a nicer young man. We're all going to be watching him do great things. I think he's going to get himself a top 10 position too. So there's some kind of exciting sort of developments in that part of the pack.
What about rookies? Do you know anything about those guys? I know it doesn't list anything here on the leaderboard that I'm looking at. Do you have any idea where the top rookie is right now?
Well, I'm going to have to get in front of my computer here. Nicholas Petit is driving.
He's in 28th right now.
Where is he exactly? I think he'd be the top rookie.
Unicleat.
Well, he's doing good. You know, that's a great team. Jim Lanier is basically sort of the Dick Clark of dog mushing. He's the guy that's about 67 years old but looks like he's in his 40s. Just an incredible gentleman and contributor to the sport. He hurt his hip. He had some sort of hip replacement, I think, this year. And anyway, last minute, kind of a last minute deal. Nicholas Petit took his, I hope I'm pronouncing his last name correctly. I apologize if I'm not. He took the team and he is running it. And, you know, he's standing on the back of a damn nice race team. So he's probably our top rookie right now.
So he is the top rookie in 28th place. So that's
so,
a respectable place. I mean, that's above halfway in the pack.
For what these drivers, especially, look, I can't say this enough. What is happening out there in this trail from all the way from first back to where he is unprecedented. This is what this looks like is the Iditarod is going to be like a cluster of drivers from here on out. That all of a sudden 20, 25 people have learned, just like seemingly overnight, but we covered this yesterday, to how to run a real competitive Iditarod. So, yeah, I would say Nicholas Petit is not only doing the top rookie of this year, he's one of the top rookies to run the race. I mean, it's just brilliant what he's doing, and I think his fans and family should be real proud of him.
And the reason I mention that, Jason, I know in 1993 you were the top rookie in your first campaign on the Iditarod, so I'm sure that that's a big accomplishment for just about everybody. And I think Ramey Smith was the top rookie, too, when he ran as a rookie. Is that true, or do you know?
Yeah, it is, and typically I'm pretty sure Ramey got the Rookie of the Year. And I'll tell you, you know, not all rookies are come in with the same amount of rookiness. You know, like you know, Nicholas Petit probably is really a sort of a genuine rookie. He doesn't have a lot of experience. One thing we saw, which is pretty exciting, a few years back was Bjørn R. Andersen was a rookie in the Iditarod, but he finished fourth place, which is was back in 2005, but you have to kind of keep in mind that these guys had come from back to back Finnmark Slopes, where he was this ultra competitive person who came to the Iditarod. He was technically a rookie, but a very accomplished racer in his own country. So rookie really just means rookie to the Iditarod.
Right.
Nicholas is probably genuinely a rookie. Another one that people had extremely, you know, where we're looking at for a potential rookie of the year was Lance Mackey's son, Kane, and. You know, that's the whole thing with being a rookie is it's tough. It's a 1,000-mile race, and it's unbelievable the amount of things that can go wrong. In fact, if you read some of the stories I've written about my 93 Iditarod, you know, I never put myself out there as being this competitive person. I always put myself out there as all the problems I had, almost all due to my poor estimation of what was required in the first place coming in the race and then maybe being overly competitive. So the Iditarod can be very punishing to – I mean, if you're a little bit underprepared and a little bit over aggressive, the Iditarod can ruin your day, ruin your week.
And Kane Carter, that is Lance Mackey's stepson. He is running right now 41st place. And another rookie right there in that same pack is Angie Taggart. She is running in 46th place. So we do have a kind of a sprinkling of rookies throughout the pack there. So let's get into this just a little bit, Jason. Let's talk about these guys, these perennial, you know, they show up every year and they run the Iditarod. Some of them do it for, you know, just to get out there and do it. Some others, I know there's a guy from Michigan, Ed, what is his name? Stelrista or something?
Ed Stelrista.
He had said that it's kind of his marketing material for his tour business that he has up in Michigan. That's the reason he does it. What do you think is some of the reasons why these guys do this that, you know, don't really have a chance of ever breaking that top 10 barrier? Why do you think that these guys come back year after year?
Well, that's an interesting way to lead into this, too, because Ed, he does. You know, he's got a real obvious reason. I mean, in fact, of the people who sort of fit that profile of just middle of the pack every time they run it and they're never really competitive, he actually probably has one of the more easy to understand reasons, which is he's got a big tour company. He's managed to sort of place himself in the public's eye, in the tourist's eye, as being, you know, a pretty competitive musher in the UP of Michigan, and he, you know, goes to the Iditarod and sort of like that sort of helps him, you know, gain traction with those people. So he's got this real reason for being able to do this. Though with that said, I always kind of wonder when he's going to step up the plate and actually put the hammer down and try to race. But You know, a lot of folks get in there, and I think it's kind of a spiritual experience. I mean, my good friend Cindy Galley is a woman who, she's not ready to ride this year, but she's got about eight of them, nine of them under her belt, maybe more. She's never been particularly, you know, she's typically running in that 35th to 45th range, very competent but non-competitive. I mean, she completely understands how to take care of herself, her dogs, and you're going to see her at the first part of the race, the middle of the race, at the end of the race, and she's always going to be competent. She always knows how to handle any situation, and she's always running a very nice team, but she's never really competent. Well, I've talked to her about that, and you know, and actually tried to help her learn to be more competitive, but you know, the reality is she doesn't really, I mean, she has probably her fantasies about doing better, but they're not in the sense that, you know, everybody saw that. I don't know if everybody saw that video of Lance Mackey at Unalakleet, but he's like, he kind of looks at the reporter, and he kind of goes, you know, if you want to do well, you got to have this fire. You know, you got to have a fire going in there. Well, you know, a lot of these drivers that are in the middle of the pack, I think they have great dog skills. They just don't have this fire. And a lot of them are, like I said about Cindy, my friend. She's a registered nurse, and that comes first. You know, she's got to work. So she has to be a working person first and a dog mushing person second. Now, that doesn't hold a lot of water because that, you know, as far as being a reason someone isn't ultra competitive, because I'll tell you something, you know, Ramey Smith has to work a real job too. And if he isn't working in the winter, he's paying a real financial price for not doing it. So, you know, I mean, that only goes so far. Again, it comes kind of down to fire. I think that some people honestly just don't really care if they're that competitive at the race, and they enjoy doing it so much. I mean, it's, you got to look at what the Iditarod is when you subtract the competitive element, all the stuff that we've been focusing on this show about this, you know, about what it takes to be jockeying for position in the front of the race, and the paycheck and the bragging rights and the glory that goes with it, and really take it apart and look at it. You know, and this goes for the Quest too. Look at what they are. They are an adventure. They are like climbing Mount McKinley or K2. They're like yes, going yes. around in a.
Jason,
go ahead,
I don't mean to interrupt you, but I'm just sitting here wondering. I mean, I understand what you're saying about not everybody is as competitive as maybe the front runners, but the Iditarod rules, correct me if I'm wrong, you have to maintain a certain level of competitiveness or they cut you out.
Yeah, well, that's kind of an extreme example, though. I mean, that's really just set up like, you know, when you see drivers fall into the cracks way behind, you know, we're not, I mean, look, I didn't think we were talking about those people really, because those are sort of few and far between. I thought we were talking about really the drivers that are kind of perennially in that 30th, the 40th, 50th range, but do it year
right.
after year.
Well,
go ahead, Michelle.
I think that this year's race is kind of extraordinary in that we haven't had anybody get formally taken out of the race because they weren't keeping up with the leaders, you know?
Well, yeah, I suspect James Bardoner was awfully close.
James Bardoner,
okay.
he said, Michelle.
I think James was real close. You know, he went ahead and scratched, but I mean, he was definitely one of the people that you'd have to say was kind of falling through the cracks. You know, I don't know. He had a good team, and every time you saw him moving, he was always moving, you know, 16 dogs, and he was always moving really well, but he was taking extraordinary amounts of rest and stopping often, and it kind of makes me wonder if he was having some health concerns on his own. I mean, he is a mid-60s-year-old man. When you meet him, he's a great guy, but he doesn't exactly strike you as being, you know, he's not like this rugged mountain man type of old logger or something. So this is really outside of his experience. So, you know, so I would say that James was definitely kind of falling through the cracks. However, he did scratch and he wasn't withdrawn. And we don't know the reason for it. And it may just be something like, you know, he felt like his health was compromised or something. But really, these middle of the packer people we're talking about aren't any burden on the race whatsoever. And the Iditarod certainly doesn't have a competitiveness cutoff in the sense of they're really looking to kind of thin the field out. It's really just to keep people, it's a safety net to keep people from falling 3 days behind the next team, you know, the next to last team.
And that, you know, with James is his name, right? James Bardoner.
Mm-hmm.
With him, he's from Tennessee. So that leads into my next question, Jason. Maybe you can answer this one. How much of a struggle is this for guys that don't live up here in Alaska? And I'm looking through a lot of the guys that are kind of perennial middle of the packers. They aren't from Alaska. I know there's two guys from Colorado that race just about every year, and they're always kind of middle of the packers. And then we have some of the guys that race from Michigan and Minnesota and other areas. How much of a struggle is that if they're not racing up here or live up here?
I'm a great example. I'm from Montana. You know, I'm going to leave James Bardoner out of that because, you know, he was a lease team, and basically, you know, for him this was kind of an adventure. He doesn't have to bear the burden of caring for the animals and having all of the all of the burden of this event, you know, on him the same way as, say, a competitive driver. Tom Thurston is the one from Colorado. Ed Steelster comes from the UP. You've seen numerous drivers. This is the first time we haven't had a competitive driver in the Iditarod for quite some time, because Doug was there for the longest time, and then I was there with Doug, and then when Doug retired, I was the competitive driver coming up. And now you have a lot of these drivers who they're coming up, and they're sort of showing sort of non-competitive. Lachlan Clark is another one from Colorado. And none of them are I wouldn't say that the fact that they're where they're at, kind of in the middle of the pack and back, is because of where they're from, but I will say that it does make it difficult. I've always considered the fact that when I come up to try to do middle distance in Alaska, or I try to do the Iditarod, I'm under far more pressure, and I've spent more money, and there's it's tougher to get the dogs up there. I'm more likely to get sick with Alaskan interior sicknesses and things like that. So I think it's much more difficult to be competitive and try to win the Iditarod from down here in the lower 48. However, I don't really think that's why we're seeing Tom Thurston at the back of the pack. Again, I just think we have a lot of these drivers who don't really have this competitive. They aren't really making the move they need to be competitive, and they're not really showing a fire. You know, if we're going to see a lower 48 team kind of step up and take the mantle of what I've had, top 15, top 10, or, you know, better yet, what Doug's had with winning from the lower 48, I mean, someone's going to have to really stoke a fire and act, you know, get themselves in gear.
Is it, you had mentioned that, you know, coming up and dealing with sicknesses that all teams get out on the trails, is it because there just isn't enough training down there? You know, I haven't done a lot of comparison between Alaska training and lower 48 training. What do you think is the biggest struggle in terms of training or preparing for the race down in the lower 48, whether it's Minnesota, Michigan, Montana, wherever?
Well, I think that part of it is just you know, really the only thing I think that you can't really train for down here is what we talked about in the first place, was getting sick. Now, that's just because if you come from here and you go up there and you meet, you know, you get some bug. It's like going to a school where all the cold viruses hit this whole school, but you're a visiting kid and you're brand new and you've never been there before and you get it. You're the one sick kid in school kind of deal. And that's really the biggest issue. As far as training, I think that what you see is a lot of lower 48 drivers kind of fool themselves. Now, I was raised in Alaska. My dog mushing career began as a small child in Alaska, with running with guys like Ramey Smith. And I'm used to the trap line trails and the old wood trails and just these nasty, nasty trails. Whereas a lot of lower 48 trails are on logging, groomed trails and logging roads, and very nice. It's all very nice. And I think that what happens is it blows the minds of lower 48 drivers when they finally get on the Iditarod Trail, and it's like it's just this windy, nasty, little bouncy, pothole-y kind of little country, you know, wood path, that I think it kind of blows their minds and their dogs and them, and they mentally aren't usually prepared for it. You know, Doug Sweeney, and if you look at the two drivers who've done well from the lower 48 in the last, you know, since it's become a 9-day race, was Jason Barron and Doug Sweeney, who have spent extensive amounts of time running and racing, developing their methodology in Alaska. So that's what you're not seeing from a lot of these lower 48 mushers. I don't think they can't prepare for it. It's just that they don't, because they just don't realize what they're getting into with the Iditarod.
And, you know, we could talk about this forever. I mean, we could talk about European mushers coming over and the whole nine, and we just don't have time for that. But that's always a question people have is they want to figure out all the little intricacies of what's going on with all of these guys. Jason, we have just a couple of minutes left. What do you want to talk about to end the show?
Well, I think that tomorrow is going to be the new champion crowned. I think it's very interesting that I think the entire top 10 is full of people who've never won the Iditarod. So we're guaranteed of a new person, a new face when they do it. One thing is, on my blog, twice before the race started, I talked about very upsetting and shaking up the hierarchy, restructuring the hierarchy. Was I said, you know, it's interesting to me that there's this feeling about the Quest and the Rondi and the Junior Iditarod, how the people people we sort of accepted were going to be the ones who would win this race, win these races, there was this huge shakeup and bizarre things happening. And I kind of predicted that this was going to happen, and I'm really kind of interested to see that it has. I mean, this is talk about a new hierarchy in the Iditarod. So I feel pretty good about that. I also just feel really good that Alaska is going to win. The Iditarod pro mushing is going to win no matter what. This is a no-lose situation for dog mushing, because if you get John Baker wins this race, and he's got it, you know, he's just looking pretty good for him right now, then the crowd goes wild. I mean, the world goes wild. John Baker is going to be a fantastic champion. If Ramey Smith beats him, and boy, you know, I'm pulling for him as hard as I can, then the crowd goes wild and Alaska wins, and the world is, you know, is a happier, better place. You know, I think that's fantastic, and that's really the note I want to leave this on, is that this entire top 10, top 12 group is just this whole bunch of kind of new contenders that are getting their moment in the sun, and it's not through default. It's because they went out there, no one gave them anything. They took it, and because I saw somebody made this comment and said, well, you know, Sebastian and Hugh are sitting there, you know, letting Dallas go, you know, take it from them. And, you know, I mean, really, you know, that's not in mushing parlance. It isn't taking anything, or it isn't giving him anything. He took it. And I think that's the impressive thing about this entire top 10, top 12 group, is they took it. And I just couldn't be happier with the way this entire Iditarod is turning out. I mean, I just think it's very exciting stuff.
You know, and what I want to say with that, Jason, is that all of the guys in the top 10, all the guys and girls, including Jesse Royer and Didi Genro, all of those guys are really fan favorites. They're really approachable to all of the fans, at least from what I know of them. So I think it'll make a really good ambassador for the next champion that wins. You know, we don't have the quote-unquote recluse in the top 10 this year that you may see occasionally. These are all guys that are really get out there and really promote the sport, don't you think?
Oh yeah, you know, I think that that's really an important quality. I mean, obviously, you know, the person who wins wins, and that's just all there is to it. But it's really a plus if it's somebody who's outspoken and somebody who can carry the race to, you know, out there to other people and just be a great ambassador. So, and I think that's going to happen. John Baker's a great ambassador, and also I think that John is a great person to win this race, and Ramey, because they're sons of Alaska. They can really sort of reinvigorate. They did run these reinvigoration. And I think that either one of these two fellows can do it. And like you said, the entire top 10. I mean, it just, there's really a lot of fantastic, outspoken, energetic people up there. And my hat's off to them. I wish them all Godspeed and good luck. And you're almost there. I mean, really watching.
Michelle, anything to close?
No, I just hope that everybody's still driving safe and they're not making their dogs too tired. You know, you guys talked about sleep deprivation yesterday. I know the dogs can feel that too, and some drivers, experienced as well as inexperienced, don't always recognize that. So I hope that everyone comes in healthy and strong, and we end the Iditarod on a fabulous note. Like Jason just said, it's going to be a new hierarchy.
And we always do need good public relations in any type of sport. And I think that with these guys, as I mentioned in closing, I think all of these guys are really going to promote this sport in the best light throughout the next year. And we look forward to seeing what happens. I know it's not over yet, but we're already looking forward to seeing what's happening the first Saturday in March of 2012. So we're looking forward to that as we go. Jason, what do you want to close with, if anything?
Well, I think that's going to do it for me. I think we're over time. I'm not sure if we even have a live audience anymore. But I think we just go ahead and keep our fingers crossed. Everybody, just like Michelle said, everybody comes on in. Dogs, drivers look happy, healthy, and end the 2011 on the best. Iditarod on the best note possible.
All right, guys, I appreciate it. We'll talk to you guys tomorrow. We will talk about the winners. We should have at least 2, 3, 4 guys coming in by the time we're on at 6 o'clock Mountain, 8 o'clock Eastern, and 4 o'clock up here in Iditarod time. Jason and Michelle, thank you. You guys have a good night. We'll talk to you tomorrow. And this is Robert Forto for Mush U Huskies. We will see you guys tomorrow night. If you have questions or comments, make sure you ask any of us on our social media, blogs, Facebook, Twitter, wherever. We look forward to hearing from you guys soon. Talk to you later. Goodbye.